Testing 1-2 myself, this is AC2GS, and according to my little pictures on my window of my computer, it looks like an actual waveform without noise, so congratulations, Lou. Okay, after much ado, let me start where I, the noise, well, you got with the noise. I want to remind everyone, as per usual, of a few things. If you want to reach me and you can't through the radio, which is unfortunately very common these days, you can reach either me for topics, the questions, puzzles. You like puzzles. I have a few puzzles available for later tonight. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him a question that's space-related or anything that Paul can handle. Yep, he loves NASA and the space. You can reach us by going to the email address, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. For links that are available, if I get to do any of my science talk articles or not, I have the links available. You can read them and peruse them at your leisure. There are also some interesting visual articles that I'm not going to really cover on the radio, but they're nice pictures of Perseverance rover and such. So that's all available on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. As always, there is a chat room available. You can either get to it by going to Limark's webpage and clicking that link, or typing into your browser chat. If you want a audio stream, I do it on the internet. That's available by just typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you a nice audio stream to W2VL repeater. I keep that around 7 days a week, 24 hours. W2LIE.net has finally brought back their link, but it's last time I listened, it was very noisy. So if you want to use my link, feel free. And always, the one of the people that are going back is 2006. So please take a look at Mike KC2NJI's archive site, which is amateurradio.tv. Okay, my present plan for the night is as follows. I will ask people if they have questions or topics and take their name down and get to them in as best an order I can do. Around 8:30, 8:45, we will call upon Andy. And if there's any time remaining, I will come back and take any further questions, and maybe we can play a little bit with agricultural puzzles that I've collected during this week. And then about 10:15 or so, it'll be time for Paul, the WSN SpaceNet report, and that should go until about 11 p.m. We'll put a bow on it, wish you well, and call it a day. So that's our game plan for tonight, hopefully. If anyone has any questions or topics for tonight, please give me your call sign and your first name.
AG2RYTV, Chris, with a question.
David recognized, I think someone doubled with David. So the person who isn't David who threw out his call sign, please repeat it.
K2SDP, Chris, with a question.
Chris recognized. Anyone else with any questions or topics for tonight? Okay, perhaps some people will have some questions later on. David, KG2RY, what's your question for tonight?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everyone. I got this message on the Pi Star for my hotspot, DMR, that the software, the Raspberry Pi, in my hotspot was out of date, and I had to upgrade. And I went through the process of upgrading by taking an image of the software and putting it onto the micro SD card that I put back into the hot spot, and maybe 2 or 3 hours of configuring, and it finally worked. But was all of that necessary, or did I have to do that, or was it not required?
Well, I don't spend a lot of time on Pi-Star. As I've mentioned before, I kind of use the open spot, which updates itself without any problem. Sometimes, usually these things are warranted. There are bug issues. There are people out there who find ways of finagling into computers and into hotspots and so much. So it could have been a security issue, I don't know, or it could have simply been a series of bug fixes. So it's unfortunate that it doesn't let you export your settings someplace. It would be nice. Again, not that familiar. I've played with a few of them, but only for a couple of weeks at a time. So I don't have that much experience with that. But yeah, it's the SD card. I mean, I almost everyone I've ever talked to who had a Pi-Star inevitably had the SD card get corrupted. It's just one of the things that's not unusual in a Raspberry Pi, given enough time. So, you know, I don't know what to tell you about any easier method of upgrading. It's sort of a shame that the people who provide the software don't make it a little bit less painful.
Yeah, but the old software was like version 3.4, 3.4 something, 3.47, and the new version was 4.14, 4.24. So I guess the upgrade was significant. It seems to be working much more stable than before. So maybe the difference paid off.
Yeah, .0, .1, .2 is just minor little flourishes. But certainly when you're going from a 3.4.something, you should really consider updating it on those releases, because they've collected a lot of feature updates or bug fixes. So I think it was a good idea that your software reminded you. You know, going from an old... That sounds like, I mean... What is that version? A year and a half ago? Developers these days.
Well, it says that the upgrade, was pretty new. This 1 or 4.2. That particular upgrade was pretty new, but the one I had might have been 3 or 4 years old.
Bravo Zulu.
It is ancient for software development, so it was the right move that you chose, even though it was a little bit painful in having to reset a bunch of things. But I think you'll get a much smoother operation out of this version than you did the previous one.
Bravo Zulu.
Thank you, Dr. Roy.
You're welcome, David. Rich, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I did. If you can hear me, there's a lot of noise, intermittent noise. It's not a constant flow of noise. So if you could hear me, I think his question was it necessary to do it? And the answer was no. Was it good that you did it? The answer is yes. And that's all I have to say. Go.
Pretty much the software was going to nag him. It depends on how it was written. It might nag him every time he pulls up the application, which could get annoying after a while. But yeah, it's always good to update. You don't necessarily have to be the first guy on the block to try out a brand new update. Most people caution to give it a couple of weeks at least to make sure that if they got something wrong, you can hear the screams of agony of bleeding edge people who have to be the first guys to have things on the new operating system. You know, some people.
Well, you know, my Fox Tango 891 Yaesu HF transceiver that just released a brand new update 4 years after the last one. So, you know, I don't know what to say. Apple Computer, their operating system 11, brand new operating system. And I don't know what to think, but they all seem to work okay.
Well, again, it sort of depends upon what they say they've done to the firmware update. It could just be a couple of bells and whistles. I've seen firmware updates that just change the color option for the number display. So, you know, you could opt out of that without any problem. Just make sure that there's no significant bug fix included in the firmware, and or if there's performance benefits or new features, whether it's important to you or not. And then you might again consider waiting about a month or so, just Googling it to see if brick their radio. And if not, you might consider somewhere then.
Well, I called Yaesu and spoke with tech support. They said they don't see any significant difference between the firmware from 2017 and the firmware from this year. There was no specific description of the improvements of it. And because of that, you know, they said you might not have to do it. I told them, you know, I have to buy a computer, you know, in order to do this new upgrade, because it only works on Windows. So I have to get a Windows laptop to update my HF radio. But maybe I don't have to do it at all. And when I was talking with Apple tech support about the new operating system, System 11, they call it Big Sur. They said that with any new operating system, you can expect a few little problems here and there.
Well, yeah, I mean, any major, when they're doing a new operating system, they're doing a major update. So it's you know, it's like going from your 3.whatever to 4.0. When you're going from 3 dot something to 4.1 dot something else, it means that most of the early changes in the complete update were squashed the bugs there. So yeah, whenever they fix things, they break other things, but if you give them enough time, they fix the stuff that they broke as well. And again, it depends upon the feature set. Yaesu really doesn't have that much going on software wise. Most of the radio is still you know, legacy, standard old IF circuits and analog circuits, so there's not that much they can do to it, whereas software-defined radios are much more tweakable. Yeah, the same thing goes even for computer BIOS firmware. A lot of the manufacturers will tell you that if you're not having any particular problems with your BIOS system, you're probably better off to just leave it at the old firmware and not update it. So it sort of depends. If Yaesu isn't that enthusiastic firmware update, then I guess you don't have to be either.
QSL. I think the radio is fine without the firmware update. But I guess my question would be, if the firmware. There's a DSP firmware, there's a main firmware. Then there's another firmware that maybe the DSP would improve, but nobody has that answer yet.
I'm not quite sure what the question is. Are you saying that there's a rumor that some future update is going to give you some kind of significant improvement, but the present one isn't? I'm not quite sure what you're getting at.
Well, I tell you, I updated the firmware in 2017. This year, in February, Yaesu released a firmware update for this radio. It's already an older radio, you know? And I'm wondering if it's possible that the new firmware update, even though they don't want to say, would give some improvement to the DSP, you know, that the filters that use a DSP will improve in their performance.
Well, in my experience, usually if you go to the company's website and look up the firmware, almost all the times I've done it in the past, there's usually a text file that lists the changes, the bug fixes, the feature adjustments, and other such. Sometimes the technicians can get a little wary and jaded and not really consider them important, and more trouble than it's worth, because I'm sure they have to deal with people who incorrectly attempted to update the firmware and it caused them to work harder, so there might be that going on for it. So I would sort of do two things. I would check the company's website under the firmware to see if there's any text file about what they've changed, and then, you know, give it a couple of weeks or a month or two, and Google the question and see if there's people on forums either complimenting the new firmware or insulting the new firmware.
Yeah. I did that. I looked at the Yaesu's website. I saw the technical information about it, and it's very vague. Port. I talked with them, and they said they don't have any answers for me either. So I told them, well, maybe I should wait some time and see if there's any response, you know, if anybody has anything to say about this upgrade.
I would agree with your assessment. If the company doesn't really want to explain what they did, they probably didn't do much, and that's probably why they don't want to explain it. So I would go with your gut and just wait a month or two. I don't think you're going to lose anything over that time period. Do a couple of little Google searches and see what people have to say. And, you know, use your own little BS meter. Sometimes guys will see benefits where there aren't any. And other guys, if they can't figure out how to turn a device on, they complain that the damn thing is broken. So with a good BS calibration, I would go and look at different forums based on a Google search in about a month or two. For the time being, I don't think you lose anything by not updating the firmware.
Bravo, Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
I would say 90% of the firmware updates are security-related, no matter what you're talking about, what type of software, what it's running. A hole in their software, and that's what the upgrades are. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I'll ask David just to double check it, but my recollection is the FT891 does not have a internet connection to it. It doesn't run that way, so the firmware is not going to get into your internet. But you know, I'll just ask David, is there an internet connection on your FT891?
To USB. USB, then there's another connection, like, you know, for audio in, audio out.
Yeah, I don't think that this particular thing is a security fix for the FD-891. Again, because I think the only thing that it's not a latest design, so it primarily has a USB audio input output and a CIV command ASCII connection. That's probably all that you're getting through the computer, and that's not going to really be shared any place I'm aware of with the internet. So in the case of this particular piece of equipment, I think it's less security and more bug fixes or tweaking of the DSP.
I was talking about in general security, I mean updates in general, no matter what it's for, whether it's for a radio or Photoshop, are more security updates than anything else.
Okay, we've had this discussion before. I think it's different for different types of software. We've talked about things like Photoshop. They've added a whole bushel basket of different features to it. So they might have stuck a couple of security measures as well, but it seems like there's a lot of improvements increasing the different options and way of handling it and such. So, I don't know, 4060, 2080, 595. I think it's different for different companies and different releases.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about major version updates where they add a bunch of features. I was just, you know, you see this all the time, you know, a new version is out, please update. Those little things that they don't explain, I'm not talking about new major features. I'm just talking about, you see them all the time now. There's a new update, why don't you download it and update your software without any version, without any new features that you could tell, that you could really, you know, make out. Go ahead.
Okay, again, it sort of really depends. I think a case could be made under some circumstances for most of the changes being security, because very often hackers find interesting ways into systems that the designers have no clue of, and if the developers are smart, they jump on it and quietly fix the leak without bothering to tell anyone. But unfortunately, Rich, you doubled with David.
I'm sorry. Let me see if I have it.
That's important to know. Maybe, you know, this radio had some issues, you know, with digital HF modes, you know, where connection to the computer and the computer and the software, and there was some issues there, but they didn't know.
The guys who would know, because I assume a lot of people call them up and ask them questions. I usually am not the type of guy to call these tech lines up, because the guys who seem to know a lot about it are busy doing something else, and the guys who don't know anything about it are not terribly useful in unfortunately, my experiences. So I tend to Google things and look up manuals and do that stuff rather than talk to these people. But, you know, I can't tell you one way or the other. The people that you talk to don't seem to be impressed with the product that they're selling. So I'm a little bit confused by that attitude.
No, Roy, I think they were very sincere. They tried to be helpful. And I told them how much I like my radio and, you know, for whatever you get for the money and the size of this radio and all the DX contacts I made with it, 100 watts and a wire up on the roof, you know, I can't complain for that. You know, I certainly got all of my money's worth. Plus, you know, there's a great receiver in there. You know, you can buy a bigger box with a TV on it and spend twice as much, you know?
Okay, but that was pretty much the electrical engineers, designers, and manufacturers, and all the other guys over in Tokyo. The guys who man the phones in the United States are more just support crew that are paid to answer the phone and tell you what they think you should do about a problem. So, I don't know. Some of those guys are nice, and some of them are very knowledgeable. And some of them are not very nice, and some of them aren't quite that knowledgeable. But, you know, what can I tell you? But, like I said before, I would not run and borrow someone's PC and just update the firmware for the heck of it. I would wait a while and base your judgment on the level of excitement, which I don't think you'll find, of people who updated the firmware. And, you know, worst comes to worst, I'm sure you know someone in the neighborhood who will let you use their PC for a half an hour just in case.
Forums are the best place to see if people are satisfied with the upgrade.
This Radius, you know, I bought it when it first came out. There were all kinds of problems with it and stuff. I had to upgrade the firmware twice. I sent first to Yaesu there. They did the firmware and the shipping within 2 weeks. And no, I think I got pretty good service on this radio, you know. And what else did I want to say? I tell you, I think it's all the radio that I need.
Okay, that's great. You know, everyone has different requirements, and as long as it has met yours, then you've made a good decision. Different people like different things. Some people like a lot of dials and knobs and buttons and lights and gold gilding on the edges and all manner of things. So, I'm glad that you find it a good product. Yaesu makes excellent products. I'm staring at my FDM 400, which I'm not using tonight, but I have it available to me. It's a Yaesu radio. So I don't have anything against any of the major manufacturers of different radios. I think, for the most part, they design good equipment.
Thanks. How far is New York City, Manhattan, from Plainview?
I don't know for sure. I would guesstimate something like 25.
KG2RY. Yeah, it's a good repeater signal, you know. I'm reading them about S4, S5. They're picking me up. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Just for my curiosity, were you able to get into the Glen Oaks repeater, or were you stuck like I was?
Glen Oaks is mostly noise for me.
Okay. Yeah, our crack technical staff has to make a couple more little tweaks and adjustments there. Chris, K2SCP, would you mind if I put your question on hold and segue into Andy's corner?
No problem at all. Go for it. I'm here. Can do it later, and if we don't get to it later, I can do it next week. No problem.
Okay, very good, Chris. Thank you for that. Well, it's 8:43, and it's time for Andy's Corner, and I'm looking forward to this Sunday night's segment. So with no further ado, I give you Andy, WA2CDL.
Okay, very good. WA2CDL here, and I've been listening in. Well, I can obviously hear myself. I know I'm getting it. I'm operating on low power, by the way. Yeah, I guess, Roy, you're in a little bit of a hole there, and given the antennas and the whole situation and so on. All right, we'll get around all this. So, good evening to everyone. It looks like today was a pretty busy day for me because I was also tapped earlier today to give a little, maybe a tune-up table talk because of the virtual flea market that Limark had today, which turned out to be a success. It was a lot of fun getting on a Zoom conference, seeing other people. So I had the opportunity to participate and was asked some questions, basic questions. So I did that. It was earlier today. And I guess the weather, with the rain and everything, was a good thing, a good day to do it. Just couldn't do that much outside. So here I am again for the second time to talk. All right, so continuing our discussion, which we didn't have last week because of some of the issues that were going on. I was talking about antenna fundamentals. I started with that topic, talking about the different types of antennas, the Hertz antenna in particular, and the antenna dimensions. Anyone remembers, we were talking about that, and wavelength, and the thing called the end effect, and how it affects the formula for figuring out the wavelength in feet of a dipole antenna. And this is referring to a dipole, which is also known as a Hertz antenna. So I guess it's, you know, it's the simplest form of an antenna, which is just a dipole. Which is, you know, in most cases, a half-wave dipole. You've got a quarter wavelength on each side. So continuing that discussion on dipoles and so on, so the next chapter, or topic, I should say, is the antenna impedance, which I did not speak about, so we'll... I don't think I spoke about that. I'm just looking back. No, I did not. Okay. So we'll talk about antenna impedance, and I... Let's see. Get into some... It depends on the time, because I'm starting a little bit late. I do have to go to work tomorrow. I got to get ready for that. So we'll see what happens. So antenna impedance, we're going to start with that. Okay, I hope everybody's like following along from week to week and so on. So the impedance that the antenna presents to the transmitter and the transmission line depends on where the signal energy is fed. Two common feed methods are shown in a figure, and that could be a current fed or a voltage fed. And normally the dipole, it's current fed because you're feeding it in the center of the dipole. But you can have also a long wire antenna, and you can feed it from the end, which is what they call a voltage feed. And that has to do with the impedance. So that is shown here in this diagram. So it says, although we have shown the current and voltage distribution as standing wave patterns along the antenna, remember that they are 90 degrees out of phase and that they vary throughout the signal cycle. So, if you just visualize that. So when the half-wave dipole is set at its center, as shown in this figure, the antenna is said to be current-fed. The current is maximum and the voltage is minimum. And again, and that's because of the phase difference between current and voltage. You know, as I said, it's 90 degrees out of phase with each other. And that's what goes on along the length of the antenna. You always have that phase relationship going on. So, impedance is low because you have minimum voltage but maximum current. You know, and it makes sense because impedance is basically AC resistance, and if your resistance is low, your current's going to be high, and vice versa. Now, I'm just adding that in. That's my own stuff. So you can understand it a little bit better. A voltage-fed antenna is shown also in this diagram, and it says, notice that the feed is at the end, where the voltage is maximum and the current is minimum. Thus, this is the high impedance point, which is maximum voltage, minimum current. So you can see what I'm getting at, so to speak. You know, if you have a 50-ohm cable, how are you going to match it? If your impedance is high, then you need a transformer, a matching transformer. So that's eventually what this all leads up to, is, you know, matching impedances to get your maximum power transfer. Again, I'm just adding that in. So, the impedance of the antenna therefore varies along its length. It is maximum at the end of the dipole and minimum at the center. This characteristic permits the antenna, and by the way, it's known as, well, you can call it characteristic impedance, but that relates more to coax cable, and they do call it that, but it says this characteristic permits the antenna to be impedance matched to a transmission line, and therefore the energy will be transformed from the transmitter to the antenna at high efficiency. And let me just read that one more time to myself. Okay, so basically it just says this characteristic permits the antenna to be impedance matched to a transmission line, and therefore the energy will be transformed. So it's permitting it to be matched, and of course you need a transformer to match that, especially to a 50-ohm cable. 50 ohms is the lower impedance. You're running a 50-ohm piece of coax. The absolute value of the antenna impedance is influenced greatly by the diameter of the wire or tubing making up the antenna and the length, expressed as the length to diameter ratio. So there is a certain ratio that this creates. For example, a thin dipole with a large length to diameter ratio has a higher impedance than just slightly off resonant. Let me just repeat that again because it's a little bit confusing. For example, a thin dipole with a large length to diameter ratio has a higher impedance just slightly off resonant than a thick dipole antenna with a small length to diameter ratio. Okay, now that makes sense. Again, I'm trying to interpret this as I need it myself. The impedance of the antenna, regardless of where it is fed, is made of two resistive components, the loss resistance and the radiation resistance. You've heard that expression before, radiation resistance. The loss resistance is made up of the wire and ground resistances. Any currents induced in nearby masts and guy wires and other conductors, and dielectric losses from objects such as trees, insulators located in the antenna field. All these losses consume power just like a resistor does. Yeah, here's an important statement here. The radiation resistance is a fictitious resistance used to account for the loss of energy by radiation. It represents the effective resistance to which the power is fed that is radiated into space. The antenna can be thought of as a sort of transformer which couples the signal energy from the transmission line into space. Yeah, we know, and we've spoken about that before. Basically, that's what it is, because I believe, you know, free space has an impedance, and I think it's I recall. You could look that up. You could do a Google search on that one. I think it's 360 ohms of free space impedance. And there's a method, by the way, that calculated that. Is that right, Roy? I'm not looking it up on my computer. The resistance of free space is 300 and something ohms, if I'm not mistaken.
If I had to pull it out of some orifice, I think something like 361 ohms is the free space impedance.
Yeah, okay. I knew it was around that number somewhere. So basically what you're doing is, you know, you're sort of coupling the energy into an impedance of free space. So the antenna can be thought, you know, as I said, sort of a transformer, which couples the signal energy from the transmission line into space. So it goes on to say, in so doing, a certain amount of effective resistance is reflected back to the transmission line output terminal. This is the radiation resistance. Yeah, so I guess because of that mismatch that occurs, because whenever you have a mismatch, you produce reflections. So they call it radiation resistance because of the mismatch between the antenna and free space itself. It's a little bit hard to understand that, but without getting into all the physics behind it. But basically, that's what it is. So, continuing, it is an actual resistance so far as the transmission line is concerned. If a resistor having the same ohmic value as the radiation resistance were connected to the end of the transmission line in place of the antenna, it would dissipate as much power as the antenna. Yeah, so you can, you know, basically what I'm saying is you can substitute a resistor for that resistance that is occurring, and it'll dissipate the same amount of power. All right. Let me just see here. Continuing. There's one diagram. Let's see if I can explain that. The combination of the loss resistance and the radiation resistance makes up the terminal resistance, the resistance to which the transmission line must feed power, and the resistance to which the line must be matched. If a short length of transmission line is used, the loss resistance is usually so small that it can't be ignored. Thus, the transmission line and the transmitter are designed to supply energy to match the radiation resistance. Yeah, it's a little bit strange the way it's worded, by the way, in my opinion, but I'm just reading it as it explains this for this particular book. The impedance, which is the radiation resistance of a dipole antenna in free space and clear of surrounding objects, has a value of about 72 ohms at the current loop, which means at the center. We'll call I call it a node, but they call it a loop, and that's really where it's feeding at the center of the dipole at the current point. So it's got a value of about 72 ohms, and that's in free space. In a half-wave dipole, this would be at the center of the antenna, as shown. Oh, so they actually say that. It's at the center of the antenna, and they show a figure of where that's located, which I just explained. Change the page here. The impedance at the voltage loop, which is at the ends, which is, you know, again, the end of the antenna, is in the range of between 1,000 and 50,000 ohms. depending on the shape of the elements and their length to diameter ratio. So, just to clarify, at the center of the dipole, you got an impedance of 72 ohms. At the end of the dipole, you got an impedance of, could be 50,000 ohms. That's quite a difference from the center to the end. Think about it. See, now you know why you need a matching transformer. Although in the center, you're succeeding with 50 ohm cables, you're going to 72 ohms. That's not much of a loss at all. It could be calculated. The reflection coefficient would be very, very low as far as the ratio is concerned. All right. So although the theoretical value of the radiation resistance of a dipole antenna is 72 ohms, the actual value depends on the closeness of buildings, trees, hills, and so on. And especially the antenna height above the ground. Yeah, the lower, if you bring an object closer to the antenna or bring the antenna closer to the ground, your impedance is going to change quite a bit. So as most people know, or maybe they don't, there's a certain height where you should put the antenna up above ground to get the maximum radiation, the maximum efficiency, maximum coupling, and so on. So it says here, they actually show a figure, and the figure shows how the radiation resistance of a horizontal half-wave antenna varies with height. And again, it's a figure, and it's actually a graph. Height above ground and wavelength, and they show this particular graph and the radiation resistance at different heights above ground. When the antenna is at least 1.5 wavelengths, 1.5 wavelengths or more above the ground, the radiation resistance is close to the theoretical 72 ohms. However, for antenna heights less than a half wavelength above the ground, serious consideration must be given to the actual radiation resistance when matching the antenna to the transmission line system and transmitter. So, you want at least a half wavelength or more above the ground to get the maximum performance of the antenna. So to get maximum transfer of power from the transmission line to the antenna, the impedance of the transmission line must be matched to the antenna. Actually says this, and I've been saying it all along. This could be accomplished by using a transmission line with the same impedance as the antenna, or by means of tuned transmission lines or other matching devices that matches the line to the antenna. And of course, there are plenty of balun out there. A balun is a B-A-L-U-N, balun. It's really balanced to unbalanced. A transformer that gives a balanced output and an unbalanced input, or vice versa, depending on what kind of transmission line you're using. And there are different impedances depending on the turns ratio of the transformer. And we can talk about transformers and turns ratio and so on at a later discussion. I think we touched on that in an earlier one, but we can go into depth of how transformers work. How they transform impedances and voltages and things like that. Okay, so transmission lines are subject. Okay, again, to say here, transmission lines are a subject in themselves, and you will study them in a later lesson and learn about matching at that time. So we will talk about that in another lesson. All right, I'm going to just talk about one more paragraph here, and that would be the folded dipole. which, how many people use a folded dipole as opposed to just a unfolded dipole? So we'll talk about that because it's a pretty short discussion. So basically up to this point, I've just been talking about, again, you know, just a standard length dipole. So the folded dipole, and it shows a diagram of it, is a half wavelength antenna with ends that are continued, folded around, and joined at the center. So if you visualize that, you just take the ends, you fold them over, and you just join them again. And that's why they call it folded. The folded arrangement increases both the bandwidth and the radiation resistance of the antenna. The radiation resistance of a folded dipole is 300 ohms. Approximately 300 is what it says. Yeah, which is interesting because most people, like myself, I don't use a folded dipole, but I could do that. So increasing my bandwidth and changing my impedance. Let me just continue. Consequently, transmission line of a higher characteristic impedance can be used to match the antenna. And that makes sense because it's got a 300 ohm feed point as opposed to 72 ohms. So this could be used characteristic impedance can be used to match the antenna, then can be used with a plain dipole. Okay. So because it's got that higher characteristic impedance, it can be used to match the antenna, then can be used with a plain dipole. That's a little bit of a convoluted statement. That's why I'm reading it twice. But basically they're saying that you could match that antenna to a higher transmission line impedance because the impedance is higher. That's what they're basically saying. Furthermore, the radiation resistance can be changed by controlling the relative diameter of the top and bottom segments of the folded dipole. And again, they show a ratio of two diameters which regulates the radiation resistance. So you can change the diameter of the wire and you'll change the resistance of it. They also show a schematic of it, electrical schematic of a folded dipole, which shows the dipole segments of unequal, this one is of unequal diameter. Yeah, so they're actually showing a thick dipole as it folds over. You're going from one diameter to another diameter. You're not keeping the same diameter as it's folded. So they're actually showing it as one diameter being a parallel resonance circuit and one diameter being a series resonance circuit because of the dimensions of the diameter of the wire. So let's see what it says about that. But it does say that the radiation resistance can be changed by controlling the relative diameter of the top and bottom segments of the folded dipole. So the bandwidth of the folded dipole is wider than of the conventional straight dipole. This means that it will work over a wider frequency range. The folded dipole antenna itself acts as a series resonant circuit, as I see here in the diagram. However, each folded half acts like a parallel resonant circuit. The resulting equivalent circuit is shown as what I just described. So the straight part, just to read it here, the folded dipole itself acts as a series resonant circuit. However, each folded half acts as a parallel resonant circuit. So, from the study of resonant circuits, and we didn't actually go into resonant circuits, I don't believe, we have learned that the two types, series and parallel, have converse reactive relationships, which we know, you know, a series resonant circuit at resonance, it just cancels the reactive components, and all you're left is the pure resistive value of the circuit. That's in a series resonant circuit. A parallel resonant circuit, by the way, is just the opposite. I'm just adding that in. But given frequency change, it says here, for example, a series resonant circuit at a frequency above resonance has an inductive reactance, while a parallel resonant circuit at a frequency above resonance has a capacitive reactance. In the folded dipole antenna, these two reactive effects cancel each other because of the shunting influences of the parallel resonant section on the series resonant antenna. That's a mouthful. Parallel resonant and series antenna. Again, you really have to visualize this if you guys are interested in putting up a folded dipole. The main thing to understand is that it's got a wider bandwidth and the impedance is much higher. It's 300 ohms. You got to keep that in mind. So, hence, the impedance of the antenna is resistive over a wider span of frequencies at each side of the resonance. And that's what there's, and that's the actual reason why it's got a wider bandwidth, because of the reactive, the frequency versus the reactive components of the dipole itself. The basic dipole antenna can also be shaped in numerous other ways, such as a cone, a fan, you know, fan dipoles are popular. You can actually take a dipole and string it any way you want, okay, to obtain certain desired bandwidths and characteristics. You can change things around by doing that. All right, it's a quarter after nine. We'll have to be moving along here. Slight discussion today on folded dipoles and impedances. And we can summarize next week as far as, you know, if you want to put up a dipole, how to match it, where to match it, what the impedances are. We'll, later on in the discussions, we'll talk about the matching, the types of matching that can be created to, you know, to achieve these goals of matching. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. And, Roy, I'll give it back to you, and this will be another chapter of My Little Corner, Indy's Corner, on the TechNet. AC2GS, WA2CDF.
Hey, thank you very much, Andy. Thank you for this episode of Andy's Corner. I just want to correct something that I said. I looked it up. The free space impedance is actually 376.7, et cetera, et cetera. So just to shorten it, most people, I think, say it's about 377 ohms free space impedance, just for the record.
Okay, thanks, Lee. Thanks on that. We were all close. Back to you.
Yes, indeed. Well, once again, thank you so much, Andy, for Andy's Corner. I appreciate it, and I look forward to next Sunday's episode. Let's get back to the list. Chris, K2STP, you have a question tonight, Chris.
I do, K2STP. I am in the middle, I was just mentioning in the chat room, of building a 6-meter antenna, which is called a barber pole antenna, which involves wrapping a 1-inch copper tape around a PVC pipe, and when you're done, it kind of looks like a barber pole spinning outside of an old barber shop. And it got me thinking and wanted to ask, I always hear the term that the antenna radiates from the skin of the antenna and not the core. So it got me thinking, at what point does the benefit of making an antenna fatter or wider with more